This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. Broadcasting live from the Rudy Luther Toyota Studios at AM 950, it's the Matt McNeil Show on your Friday. Good to be with you today. Matt and Brett here. Brett in on a Friday. Brett, you've got a nice little conversation. I believe it is the Senate Minority Leader, Melissa Franzen, right?
Yeah, Melissa Lopez Franzen, going to be on as we'll be talking through the relief money for frontline workers and, yeah, why she thinks we need to make that a much bigger pool of workers that get that money, since Republicans seem to forget about all the wonderful ways we were honoring retail workers and meatpacking workers last year and then forgot about them.
Oh, well, no, that's absolutely, you know, that's one of the things which I've talked about quite a bit is that, you know, it's all these Republicans demanded grocery store workers get back to work. Get in there and work. You know what you were doing. And now all of a sudden it's like, well, we made a sign for you.
We banged some pots and pans. That's
We applauded for you once. I mean, come on. What else do you expect from us? We're Republicans. All right. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Okay. I understand that this is a audio medium. Okay. I get that wholeheartedly. Okay. But I got to talk about a visual story, which is just freaking hilarious. If you have not seen it, do you know where Victory Memorial Parkway is in Minneapolis? It's kind of on the north side of
Oh, there's a bike trail. I've gone to that many times.
Okay. You go north of Theo Worth. It's up there. It's actually a gorgeous part of town. Very pretty. And I've had some friends that have moved up there in that area. They say the housing prices are great. And, you know, and of course, if you go to the very northern end of it, they actually have the military memorial. Those were kind of the parade grounds they've had at times. But it's a very cool park and I think a very undervalued park.
Great prices in terms of sellers or buyers. I imagine that's got to be an expensive area, doesn't it?
Not as expensive as a lot of places in Minneapolis. And you get a really nice house, too. So there you go. It's if you haven't seen it, go out there. It's I've always thought it was one of the nicer parts out there. So they've got a walking path there. All right. And someone was supposed to paint a straight line dividing the walking and biking paths on Victory Memorial Parkway in Minneapolis. You've got to see the images of this to do it justice. It is quite literally the worst straight line I have ever seen in my entire life. Like, almost comically bad. Like, were you guys, you were looking forward to Arby's all of a sudden, realize, oh my God, Arby's, we got to get there now. And you just started gunning it. And
I was thinking maybe beverages could have been involved too.
Oh, it could be. It seriously could be. If you go to bringmeinthenews.com, they've got the story there. Nate Pence, a local realtor, spotted the meandering repainted lines Thursday afternoon near 43rd Avenue, shared a few photos on Twitter, writing, whomever did it should probably be given a new assignment at the park board. I would agree with that. Someone then alerted Commissioner Chris Meyer of the Minneapolis Park and Recs Board, who promised he'd ask to get it fixed ASAP. And within 9 minutes of Pence's off-liked tweet, the board put out a statement beginning with a simple oof, O-O-F. There's no way you can hide from this one. The statement continued, putting the blame on the subpar contractor. Oh, that is, you do not need to put the word subpar there. Well, that's a given. If you happen to be walking or biking in Victory Memorial Parkway paths that evening and notice some wobbly lines, it's not you. Striping was completed by a contractor today and it does not meet our standard specs. It will be covered and restriped to standards ASAP. You got to go see this.
One of the lines looks like it's going into the shoulder. Off by so much. We start in the middle, and we just kind of veer off.
It's like you had a seizure while you were painting it. Correct me if I'm wrong. Aren't those cars, you put the paintbrush down, you lock it into place. So all you have to do is just drive straight, and you're gold. Maybe it was.
Kart style. They were trying to drive. Trying to actually follow that line, yeah.
That is... Oh, gosh. It is a thing of beauty because it is quite literally you had one job. You had one job. It is the epitome of the you had one job standard. And holy cow, they're screwed up. And then there is screwed up. If you'd like to catch a glimpse of the now internet famous Victory Memorial Parkway lines, you need to make a quick trip because it appears that soon, if not already, they'll be back to their straight edge. That is relatively embarrassing, to say the least. I also wanted to make sure I mention from the get-go today, the top of the show, Medtronic is warning. This is scary as hell. Medtronic is warning more patients who use some of the company's older insulin pumps about cybersecurity vulnerabilities that could allow hackers to harm patients by changing the drug delivery settings. Okay, wait a minute here. These are on Wi-Fi? Ugh. Medtronic, which is operated at headquarters in Fridley, previously issued a warning in 2019 about the issue, which was thought at the time to apply to at least 4,000 patients. The updated recall now applies to 31,310 devices, continues to be considered by the Food and Drug Administration as a Class 1 recall, which is the most serious type. The insulin pumps in question were introduced to the market before 2013. To date, the FDA is not aware of any reports of patient harm related to the potential cybersecurity risks. In patient notifications the company began issuing Tuesday, Medtronic said further review determined the potential risk of using the remote controller outweighing the benefits. In the results, the patient should immediately stop using it and disconnect the remote controller, disable the remote feature, and turn the remote controller to Medtronic. Medtronic first communicated this recall to some users in August of 2018. Sent it to notice to patients. At that time, only users whose pumps were under warranty received the recall notification. Oh, that's nice. Nice of you there. Medtronic is now expanding the notification to all users of Medtronic believes still might be using a MiniMed 508 insulin pump or the MiniMed Paradigm family of insulin pumps and have purchased a remote controller. Okay, can I just say this from the get-go? Isn't that kind of dangerous anyway? Having a remote controller? Your grandkids come on over and why isn't the TV controller working? And you're actually dosing grandpa like 40 times. I don't know if remote control is a good idea on this. People with diabetes use pumps to deliver insulin to management of their condition. The MiniMed system included an optional remote controller to communicate wirelessly the pump amount. That is scary, man.
I mean, you could get a little kid that, oh, it's a remote. I want to press buttons on this.
Beep, 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 beep. No, it's a bad idea in the first place, but the fact that they can be hacked now, I mean, you can be hacked and be dosed. Ugh, that's not a good sign. That is not a good sign. So I'm going to repeat this once again. It's the MiniMed 508 insulin pump or the MiniMed Paradigm family of insulin pumps. And if you've purchased a remote controller, and once again, if you do have the remote controller, get rid of the remote control right now. That's probably what you want to get rid of right away because it sounds like that's where the vulnerability is coming in. 952-946-6205. I guarantee I'm going to get controversial as all get-go in the second half of the 5 o'clock hour. I mean, controversial. Brett and I, we are going to anger people. I'm going to save that, though. But what I'm going to promise you is this. It's not going to be Dr. Matt's gloom time depression hour as it has freaking been here because of the coronavirus. It is. I will be the first time. I'll be the first to admit it. Some of these days are dark, man. It's not as bad as it was last summer. Because last summer, quite literally, I was almost in tears half the show because of what had been going on with the coronavirus and, of course, George Floyd and the protests and, oh, my God, and what was going on. It was rough. And, I mean, we're not as bad as that right now. But, gosh, I would really appreciate in the realm of coronavirus some news that wasn't so damn stark. you know, give me one little, you only are getting like occasionally one little blip of positivity, and it just, yeah. So I'm going to just, for my own sanity, for your sanity, for Brett's sanity, too late. But for you and me, Brett aside, we are going to, we'll have a different topic. I'm going to get into something I don't want to hear about. I can't believe you're wasting your time talking about this. Damn right I am. This is going to be an intervention to get away from all the negativity we have to deal with at times here. 952-946-6205. And of course I'm dancing at the end of the show. Speaking of which, it's get rolling on with Dr. Matt's Gloom Time Depression Hour. There you go. I do have Mike Lindell stories to begin next hour, too.
Oh, yeah. He's unfortunately on the news.
I got some good Mike Lindell stuff. Friday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 3,661 new cases, 20 new reported deaths. 16 of the 20 deaths were in October. 4 happened in September. Pardon me while I scroll here. The state death toll is now 8,295 since the start of the pandemic. As of October 6th, the state reported that 3,420,016 people have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine, while 3,250,511 people have completed the vaccine series. Through October 7th, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 871. Good news, a little good news, is down from 881 the day before. Of those hospitalized, 236 people are in intensive care and 635 were in general hospital care. The 3,661 positive results on Friday's update were from 54,540 completed tests, creating a test positivity rate of 6.71%. Minnesota's test positivity rate over the past 7 days has been 9.06. Minnesota is above the caution threshold of the 5% test positivity rate, but it hasn't been above the 10% warning level since December during the state's most severe pandemic wave and just before COVID-19 vaccine became available. The state also reached a 7.6% rate in April before infection levels declined and prompted Minnesota leaders to withdraw mask mandates and social distancing requirements. Health officials encouraged unvaccinated Minnesotans to get shots. More than the 75% of eligible people 12 and older in Minnesota have received at least the first doses of COVID-19 vaccine, according to the Centers for Disease Control, which reports a higher vaccination rate because it includes doses provided at the federal facilities that haven't tracked or that aren't tracked by the state, such as the VA. Thank you, VA. I love my Pfizer shots. I appreciate that. COVID-19 models and by the Mayo Clinic and other groups continue to project flat or steady growth in coronavirus infections in October, with the potential to decline in November. Minnesota had the 8th highest rate of new infections among states over the past 7 days, according to the CDC data, as the pandemic wave that has emerged from the south this summer spread to the upper Midwest this fall. And thank you very much, unvaccinated idiots, because of you, we're going through this. And the reality is there's, you know, you're so just damn determined to prove that I love Donald Trump so much. Yeah. Hope you love him enough to where it's going to get you the ICU. For God's sakes. Get vaccinated. I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. And I don't want you bankrupt. Dear Lord, I mean, how many times do I have to say that? I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. I don't want you bankrupt. More on coronavirus news in a second. But Gary is in Minneapolis. Gary, welcome.
Matt,
in.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing okay, Gary. How are you?
I just want to say something quick, as I can.
All right.
You know, these environmental refugees, so many of them are environmental refugees at the border, and our republic is always bringing up all the immigration is coming because of Biden and stuff. I hope that backfires on, because we're going to get more and more of that as the environmental conditions get worse. They're having trouble growing some of their crops down there in South and Central America. And then also they have those corrupt governments, and our country had a little bit to do with that, putting them puppets in there. Some of them.
Yes.
So that's about it. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Gare. I appreciate it. You have a good weekend, my friend.
He drove to Niagara Falls, by the way, a couple of weeks ago.
He did?
With a friend, yeah. Isn't that crazy? It's a long drive.
Did he get married?
No, he did not get married there. No, no.
See, that's the old thing. He used to go to Niagara Falls to get married.
Maybe he did, and he didn't tell me.
Well, maybe.
Buried the lead.
Well, It's a big waterfall. It's also very pretty.
Yeah.
It should be known. It's also very pretty if you haven't been. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I will mention as well, we are starting to get to a point where the hospital beds are, we're running out of them. And we've talked over the last few weeks multiple times about the number of people who are just trying to go get regular, routinely scheduled medical procedures done that don't have any dang thing to do with coronavirus being put on hold because of belligerent idiots who refuse to get vaccinated taking up hospital beds. You know, I said this the other day, and I stand by it. I've come to the belief at this point, the whole goal of the Republican Party to push this anti-vax mentality, to push this anti-mask mentality, is to basically turn the United States into a pit so that they might have a chance at the elections. They don't care anything about the constituents. Because I can't – how is this controversial? I don't want you dead. I don't want you sick, and I don't want you bankrupt with medical bills. How the hell is that controversial? But yet the Republicans, who are just desperate to basically watch the country freaking burn, have basically turned on their own constituents as the constituent says, yay, kill us all! Kill us all! Start with my kids! Dear Lord. You guys are broken to the freaking core. That's what it is. You're broken to the freaking core. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. We'll come on back. More of the Minnesota coronavirus update. And, you know, an obvious reality right now in the state of Minnesota, it is far safer in the cities than it is in outstate Minnesota. I'll get to that as well. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Lynette is in Chaska, kind enough to join us today. Lynette, thank you very much for holding.
Hi, Matt. I just wanted to call in to say this whole thing about when people don't want to get the shot because of freedom, I wanted the freedom to not go to the hospital. I wanted the freedom to have my health. I wanted the freedom to not be on a ventilator. I live alone. I mean, it's like if you have a family, I mean, I guess if you have a family, you're going to put this huge burden on your family. I mean, because now you're not there. Now somebody's got to make up for the fact that you're not there. And then some people say, oh, I just don't like needles. Do you know how many needles they put into you when you go to the hospital? I mean, you're going to have needles in you all the time. They got to take your blood.
Yeah.
They got to, I mean, this idea, I don't want to go to the hospital. And so when I had the choice of the freedom not to go to the hospital and to be sick, that's a bigger freedom than to risk getting ill or to have long-term side effects.
Absolutely.
What's free about that?
Exactly, Lynette. No, your points are perfect, and thank you very much. I appreciate the phone call. No, I have the right to not have some selfish jackass who basically just doesn't care sicken me and my entire family. I have that right in this country too. And, it's kind of one of those things. If you're vaccinated, if you're wearing a mask and something happens, okay, fine. I mean, it's a nasty virus. But when you have some person who's, I ain't never going to get vaccinated. I'm never going to get a mask. Maybe I shouldn't have gone to church. Well, didn't your the rest of your parishioners or your coworkers or your friends, didn't they deserve the chance to not get sick from you? Apparently not in your world. Because God forbid a minor sacrifice, a minor inconvenience actually, is done so that you can, help ensure the safety and the betterment of society. Heaven forbid. When students returned to the University of Minnesota Twin Cities campus last month, it was with the understanding they'd be vaccinated by October 8th. Looking at the old Johnny calendar, it is indeed October 8th. Now that the deadline is here, the university officials say most students have complied with the vaccine mandate. I filled mine out yesterday. They sent me a reminder email. It said sophomore Max Moffor, M-O-F-F-O-R. I've been vaccinated since April, got my first dose, May my second dose. Students have until Friday to submit a COVID-19 immunization verification form certifying they've been vaccinated or ask for a religious or medical exemption. University officials say as of 2 weeks ago, 75% of all students had filled out the form. As of Monday, roughly 97% of those students had been vaccinated. It makes me feel a little bit safer going to the classrooms and knowing people are wearing masks, but they're also vaccinated. Let's see here. Oh, there we go. Also vaccinated, so there's an extra layer of protection, said sophomore Molly Peters. University officials say students who don't make the deadline won't be kicked out of class right away, but a hold will be placed on their record, so they won't be able to register for any courses in the future until they comply. From my perspective, I think they should get vaccinated, said sophomore Ayed Alashabibi. I want them to get vaccinated, but that's their choice. I can't do anything to get them vaccinated. Students we talked about will say getting the vaccine won't completely eliminate the risk of contacting the virus, but it's a small price to pay to get back to campus instead of learning online the year. That my son, Charlie, he's over at the U, and you know his first year was spent in a dorm room, basically. And you know he's glad he went. He's glad he did it. And you know he's right now he's going to classes, and he tells you he's been very blunt in how much he's enjoyed going to classes. And the reason why they're able to go to classes is because it's a minor inconvenience. Interesting hiring numbers here that are involved with the coronavirus. I should mention this. People are leaving the nursing home industry faster than they can be replaced. And that's led to a record staff shortage in Minnesota. Survey of 300 care providers statewide conducted by the Long-Term Care Imperative found there are now 23,000 unfilled senior caregiver positions across Minnesota. That compares to 8,000 last March. Now, I will be honest here. As I read this number, remember when this thing started, we were hearing about long-term care facilities where it didn't really seem like there was a lot of care going on. And it didn't seem like they didn't care about their workers. They didn't care about their residents. Now, I think things are getting cleaned up now. Especially once we started realizing the danger of having, you know, unregulated and callously run senior long-term care facilities. But, and as a matter of fact, I think one of the reasons why we had so many losses early on in this crisis, in the long-term care facilities. So, it's something, once again, that it doesn't surprise me to a point, but these numbers are pretty bad. Once again, there's 23,000 unfilled senior caregiver positions right now compared to 8,000 last year. Another sobering stat, in August, the industry lost 2,000 more workers. For every 100 people hired, 150 called it quits. Burnout from the pandemic was often cited. They're exhausted. They're totally exhausted from working 100-hour work weeks, double shifts, and full PPE during a really hot summer, said Patty Cullen of Care Providers of Minnesota, told reporters during a press conference where the survey results were revealed. The shortage has become so acute, in fact, that 70% of nursing homes in the same survey said they've capped admissions of new patients until they can hire more people. That reverberates back to upstream to hospitals who have to keep fragile patients because they can't find spaces for them in nursing facilities. We'll be honored to care for everyone who chooses us. We just don't have enough staff, said Aaron Hilligan of Ebenezer Homes, remarked. When we can't accept seniors in our buildings, we see backups in hospitals that impact the delivery of health care for everyone. At Episcopal Homes, which hosted Thursday's event, they have 50 unfilled positions across all job descriptions, which is about 10% of its workforce. CEO Marvin Plackett said, it's been hard filling spots, even in the facility located next to a giant light rail station in an area populated by college students and immigrants. We cannot find enough staff. How much harder, extremely much harder, is it for those who are in rural communities and in distant suburbs to find the staff? It's interesting. We've raised pay. We've shifted work differentials. We've provided bonuses. But there's a limit. We don't have an endless budget. We need help from the state government. Industry leaders are pressuring state lawmakers to tap into federal COVID relief dollars, deliver emergency funding to help hire more staff. They're also asking lawmakers to create special strike forces, temporary emergency staffers that can be deployed to nursing homes. What's interesting is I read today about, is it Cane's Chicken? Cane's Fried Chicken, the chain, the restaurant chain. One of the more interesting responses to the hiring shortage they put forward is that they're a good chunk of their executive corporate staff are now out at restaurants working in the restaurants. As the one guy said, I'm a CFO, I'm a COO, but I'm also a cook and a cashier if I need to be. And I was like, okay, that's actually a good response. I mean, if you are a corporate overlord, that is actually the response you should have. Because isn't that part of the problem is that the people that work in a lot of these corporations in the executive offices feel as if many of the jobs that are not filled are beneath them. And so yet to see someone like Raising Cane's Chicken basically go out there and say, no, all of our corporate people are in this in working in stores. That's an interesting, I got to admit, I respect that. That's what you need to do. That's business. You're not above any job within that company. You're not above any job within that company. And I think that's part of the problem they have here. I will also say in regards to nursing homes, I've had multiple family members who are nurses who have worked in senior care facilities. And as they have said, is that it's generally not very good pay. And, you know, what we've got is a world where the margins, corporate margins have been so tight for 30 years that the idea of actually getting away from this, and this is the real crime of America right now, as far as employment goes, is that we have a system that was based on people getting crap wages, getting no benefits, not having a safe work environment, and that any change to that metric, any of those metrics, was too much for these corporations to have. The entire goal, there was never a plan to raise minimum wage. There was never a plan to start offering more benefits. It just was not on the horizon for many of these corporations. And henceforth, having to deal with this real crisis where people are saying, well, I'm just not going to work there. It's presented a very interesting problem because the margins are that tight. And I think really the only answer you've got is to pay more money to the staff and then in charge more money to your customers. But if that's where you're at, and this is where, you know, you're at the point, like in the case of Raising Cane's, where corporate leaders are actually going in and working because there's such staff shortages. Well, what other options you got? And that's just the reality of it. That is just the reality of it. And we talked about one of the things we talked about when we started noticing these people not going back in the workforce is the cost of daycare. People are intelligent and they can basically make the decision to themselves, or most people are intelligent, I should say it like that. But people can make the call themselves if me working three jobs is only getting me enough money to where I can cover my daycare costs, then what the hell am I doing working the three jobs? I'll just stay at home and I'll stay with my kids. Problem solved. So unless so people will figure this stuff out. It's just that you've got to make your product, your job in that case, more desirable and hope that basically you can cover costs. Because the reality is this whole thing, this was set up for decades. This house of cards collapsed because of coronavirus, but it's the reluctance on a lot of levels in a lot of industries and a lot of businesses to actually acknowledge the fact that, well, maybe we should, after so many years, pay more money and give benefits and have a safe work environment. It's the reluctance to embrace those three things that's causing a lot of places to have a lot of staff shortages. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. When we come on back, I'm going to play off a little bit more about what I was talking about yesterday, the Republicans only caring about the 2%, as well as also where is it really safe in the state of Minnesota? Because the answer will shock you. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. By the way, if you get the chance, the leaves are starting to pop in some areas. I saw some really pretty trees the last few days. Real nice. I was out hiking today. I was at Purgatory Park out in Minnetonka. I was out there the day before. I was down in Tierney Woods, down in that'd be Bloomington. So I've been out getting into the woods, but it's still is real inconsistent. So get out, get the chance. It's not that bad out there. Thank you very much, by the way, to Todd Colet, who sponsors AM950. Of course, moved to Spain, can't really go and visit our clients, and so he wanted to sponsor the station because he listens all the time and he's a big fan. So he does. He basically sponsors a week, and we talk about, in his case, the band Just Folk, who's got a brand new song out there, Is It Monday? We've been talking about that for a few months, and you can go see the video. There's links on my social media pages. You can go click on that and view the video. By all means, please do. Thank you very much, Todd. If you'd like to do what he is doing, give us a call, 952-946-8885, 952-946-8885. So yesterday I brought up, there's just two realities that, two myths from the Republicans that yesterday just we completely and totally annihilated as far as any kind of reality-based notion. The first one was this idea. We talked about that one of the Senate committees, Republican-led Senate committees in Minnesota, had a hearing to talk about the real victims of this crisis. State workers that don't want to get vaccinated and refuse to get tested. Basically, it made it seem like there's this, what about, and let's make sure we're clear here. I mean, the implication from Republicans is that this is some mass part of our population, that this is a large group. They're just, this is big government out of control. And the numbers yesterday from Axios Twin Cities showed, well, wait a minute here. 73% of all state workers have agreed to get vaccinated. 25% who did not want to get vaccinated agreed to get tested, which means the Senate Republicans were only concerned with 2% of the state workers. That those, in their minds, the rights of those people to go into the workplace and sicken and possibly kill as many other state workers as possible was tantamount, was the priority, was the apex of their goal. 2% of selfish people who do not care about their coworkers, that was their big concern. And once again, what are they fighting for? They don't want to get vaccinated. They don't want to be tested. So they basically want to be able to go in, if they, regardless if they're sick or not, and go into the workforce. And if they get people sick, they don't want to be held accountable. And that's what this is. It's just selfish people that, when they do things that they need to be held accountable for, chewed out for, at least condemned publicly for, they don't, you can't get mad at me. The state said I could do this. That's what this is all about. And that's what Republicans are doing. The Republican Party is trying their hardest to give 2% of state workers the right to sicken and possibly kill the other 98%. Brave stance there, Republicans. Yee.
I sense a theme of Republicans only caring about 1 or 2% of people.
Yeah, they do.
That's not just vaccines.
That's just who these cats are, man. And that's just the reality. That's who's, and this is why I come to this theory. It's like, I think they're just basically trying to, you know, keep this pandemic going as long as they can. Who in their right mind? I mean, they had those numbers. They knew exactly how many people in the state of state employees they knew it was only 2%, but yet they're like, this is the hill I'm going to die on. I am really here representing the real victims, the selfish jackasses. That's, I mean, dear Lord. But there was something else after the show that struck me. And it goes back to, okay, first of all, let me preface this by saying this. Have you seen how Republicans like to cover news in Minneapolis, St. Paul? Oh my God. They most Republicans really want to scream black people. You know, that's kind of who they are, but they want to, and they don't want to, pretty much equally want to scream black people, but instead they use code words and they talk about, oh, the violent crime in North Minneapolis, where the North Minneapolis people live. you know, that's kind of who they are. That's, they're talking about this. But they, every time there is a tragic death, and there have been quite a few, let's not deny that. I would make an argument the police not really going on patrol is a big part of that. But hey, potato, potato. Needless to say, there has been a lot of death in Minneapolis and St. Paul and around the state, for that matter. Crime numbers are up nationwide, if you want to know the truth. Homicide rates are up nationwide. In the same sense is that, you know, there's lots of accidents that are going on, and a lot of accidents, car accidents, that are going on in outstate Minnesota. People are flying down the roads and getting into a lot of accidents. They're having some problems. So, you know, there is this problem that exists here where you get this narrative that is being thrown about, bandied about Minneapolis, about how unsafe it is, how dangerous it is. Oh, you're going to die if you go there. You're going to die if you go there. And no, no. It's, don't get me wrong, there is a bad crime problem, but it's not everywhere. And, you know, it's something that we need to deal with. And I guarantee you one way or the other after this election, this is probably going to be dealt with on a fairly severe basis. Anyway, that being said, when you look at what's safer, because that is really what they're trying to say. Is that what Republicans, especially outstate Republicans, are trying to say is, it's not safe there. Thank God I don't live there, because it's not safe there. Something dawned on me. When I started thinking this through, I said, wait a minute here. Wasn't there a story from Bring Me the News a few weeks ago, which there was, that talked about how not only have we, and we talked about this yesterday on the show, we talked about how when you look at where the counties are, where the worst rates of infection are happening, they're all outstate counties. Holy God, it's just a mess out there. All Republican districts in outstate parts of the state. That's where the worst of this is happening, where Republicans have downplayed the importance of vaccines, downplayed the importance of masks while they've got the mess on their hands, while everyone says, yay, thank you for making my entire family sick. I can't figure it out. I at that point, I wouldn't be voting for him, but yeah, potato, potato. But the reality is that it's not just that's where the cases are. It's not just, as I mentioned yesterday, that the majority of school districts which are having coronavirus outbreaks or five or more cases, those are outstate districts as well. But it's also the amount of people who are dying is as well. Figures from Monday, October 1st, showed, and I went back and I found the story, 13 of 21 deaths occurred outside of the 7-county metro area. Friday, on Friday's numbers, which were from Thursday of that previous week, it was 9 out of 17 deaths. Also, Monday and Tuesday of that week, that more came from Greater Minnesota, 19 out of 33. If you do the numbers, outstate Minnesota, outside of the 7-county metro area, is somewhere generally between 55 and 60% of the deaths that are happening out there with coronavirus. And we're talking about 20, 30, even 40 deaths per day. The majority of them are happening out in rural Minnesota. And I should also mention, as I say, 55 to 60%. And there are some days where, and I will be very clear here, there are some days where the majority of deaths are coming from the 7-county metro area, but most of the days now, just like these other stories, are pointing to outstate Minnesota, where the vast majority of the deaths are coming from, 55 to 60. As should be mentioned, the 7-county metro area has 55.5% of the entire state's population, which means outside of the 7-county metro area, they only have 44.5% of the state's population, which means in outstate Minnesota, 44.5% of the entire state's population are getting somewhere in the area of 55 to 60% of the deaths. This isn't even close. This isn't even close. It is far more dangerous right now in outstate Minnesota than it is in the Twin Cities. Gun crime or not, far more people are dying in rural Minnesota right now than they're dying in Minneapolis. Now, mind you, once again, Republicans talk about what's going on in Minneapolis because black people shooting each other is something they can use to try to drive narratives in their Republican districts in outstate Minnesota. But the reality is, and this is factual, it is far more dangerous right now in Minnesota to be in outstate Minnesota than it is to be in the 7-county metro area. Far dangerous. The numbers don't lie. More people are dying out there. More people are getting sick out there. More school districts are having outbreaks out there. And it's not one or two people a day. It is 5, 10 more people per day out in an area which has got 44.5% of the state's population versus the 7-county metro area with 55.5. It is far more dangerous out there. And you should keep that in mind. And if you have that friend, you have that neighbor, you have that person who is out there going, well, wait a second here, you metro area people, it's so dangerous there. You say, it's not dangerous here, it's dangerous out there. Because you guys are so determined to not get vaccinated and so determined to not wear masks, you're going to get to a point here where you're lapping the 7-county metro area with deaths out there. Tell you right now, I'm perfectly content staying in the safe metro area. Thank you, Minneapolis, St. Paul. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Those are numbers. I mean, you may not like the numbers, but those are the numbers. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. The numbers don't lie. If the part of the state that's got 44.5% of the population is having 55 to 60% of the deaths with coronavirus, you can try to sensationalize gun crimes in Minneapolis all you like. It's far more dangerous in rural Minnesota right now than it is in the Twin Cities metro area. It is far more dangerous. Your likelihood of dying right now in rural Minnesota is far more greater than it is in the Twin Cities metro. It absolutely is. But that's thanks to the Republican Party of Minnesota. That's their. You want to look at me and get mad? You can, by all means, you're more than welcome to. You won't be the first person. You won't be the last person. But I'll just be honest. You need to go look in the freaking mirror because the people that have made rural Minnesota, outstate Minnesota, into the freaking mess it is are the guys that are out there saying, we're the Republican Party. No, they've turned you into a death, cult out there. And I would be mad. I mean, if you, considering how they sensationalize what's going on in Minneapolis, St. Paul with crimes here, if I found out, well, it's actually more dangerous in rural Minnesota because of coronavirus right now, I would be demanding answers from my Republican politicians on why are we so anti-vax? Why are we so anti-mask? 952-946-6205. Speaking of things that made me mad, House Select Committee will swiftly consider making criminal federal referrals for Steve Bannon if he continues to defy their subpoena. Bannon's lawyer told the House investigators that Donald Trump had instructed him not to comply on the basis of executive privilege, but committee chairman Representative Benny Thompson of Mississippi said, and Liz Cheney, a Republican, said they would not wait for a court to settle the dispute. We will not allow any witnesses to deny a lawful subpoena or attempt to run out the clock, and we will swiftly consider a criminal contempt of congressional referral, Paris said in the statement. The lawmaker said the White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and former Defense Department Chief of Staff Kash Patel have been engaging with the committee while long-term Trump aide Dan Scavino had been hiding, but apparently not so much longer. This is breaking news. Former White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications Dan Scavino was finally served his subpoena on Friday by the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack. On September 23rd, the Select Committee announced it would be subpoenaing Scavino, but the little coward's been out freaking hiding, and they apparently tracked him down. They found him, and they served him his papers. This is the Trump thing. Trump is going to try to insist that he has executive privilege. No, he's not the president anymore. Second of all, executive privilege does not convey over to crimes committed while you were in the White House. Biden today as well went out there and said, I'm not going to hold back on these documents. The Senate Investigation Committee can have, or the House Investigation Committee can have these documents. And so, I mean, it comes down to whether or not enough of the Republicans on the Supreme Court will basically pull a ruling out of their backside and make one of the more political rulings in the history of this country to keep Trump stuff, you know, quiet. What I will say is this. If that's going to happen, it's going to happen. But Democrats, you've got a choice here. Democrats, you've got a choice. They're not back. They're not obeying your subpoenas. Well, then haul them into court. Go get law enforcement. You know, put them in contempt. Track them down. We're not talking about what is the usual crimes people get away with. You know, minor things like starting wars in wrong countries or stealing millions of dollars through some sort of shady investment deal. No. Those light hand slappers. We're talking about the attempted overthrow of democracy itself. And so, and we have clearly have enough evidence that Trump is guilty as hell. And so the question is how intent are you to hold the people accountable for nearly destroying the United States accountable? Because if it's the Democrats of yore, it's going to be, well, we think we've sent a very strong message. Here's my serious wagging finger. But if you're going to start playing this game like the Republicans do, which you should, go and round up these clowns and chuck them in jail and then bring them in to talk. Hour two of the show, that's coming up next. We have it on good authority. Minneapolis Parks and Rec are currently out repainting the insanely swervy line that was supposed to be straight on the walkway pathway in Victory Park. That is, we have an eyewitness account to the fact that they're out there.
AM 950 Action News can confirm.
It can confirm that they basically, they are embarrassed. If you did not hear earlier, there was someone, you got to go to bringmethenews.com and you can see the story. Someone at Victory Memorial Parkway, a subcontractor, was supposed to paint a straight line down the road. But what do you think that they were driving the vehicle? Because, I mean, this wasn't some guy with a paintbrush.
It might have been.
Well, actually, I shouldn't rush to
picture
judgment.
Some guy on his hands and knees crawling the whole time.
Or just one roller and he's just kind of walking. Yeah. That's straight enough. It's just straight enough, dude, whatever. I'm going to guess this. You and I have actually brought up the thing. Was he drunk?
Oh, I think that could very well be possible.
I think that we should also question the possibility, the realm of other drugs being involved. But I actually, you know what I think it is? I think he was on whatever it is, like a lawnmower with a paintbrush on the back. You know what I'm talking about? One of those park vehicles they'll have it's not really a vehicle that would run on the street, but it's a big thing. And it's like a golf cart that on steroids, and it's got a paintbrush on the back of it. What do you guess the guy was on his cell phone?
Oh, I was just going to go.
On his cell phone. Okay, good enough. Oh, yeah. Oh, let me do a few texts here. Oh, without a doubt in my mind.
That might be the most likely scenario. Yeah, he's just on his phone the whole time.
I would make an argument that is. I think we've discovered the culprit. Hey, thanks, subcontractor. I'm going to guess you're not going to get any more work. I'll take a dive into the dark here. You and I had talked before about Idaho, the mighty state of Idaho. Hey, nice taters. Idaho plans to bill MyPillow CEO Mike Lindell, our good friend. Well, not really, but we always wish. We just wish he would.
Well, he stops by every now and then.
Well, that's the cardboard cut.
Oh.
It's not really him. They're planning to bill him for three audits the state carried out to disprove his false claims of election fraud. Chief Deputy Secretary of State Chad Houck, H-O-U-C-K, confirmed the office will bill the pillow magnate for about... God, is this the weirdest timeline in the history of this... The bill the pillow magnet Okay. For about $6,500 in costs associated with auditing the three counties after Lindell falsely claimed that presidential election results in all 44 counties were electronically manipulated to change votes from Donald Trump to Joe Biden, reported the Idaho Statesman. Reminder here, and I want to remind everyone, this is Idaho. They called Idaho like 4 days before the election for Trump. I think he won like 72%, 70, 60, something like that percent of the vote in Idaho. And he's challenging it, saying it was more. Why not try to get Lindell to reimburse the state for having to refute his false claim, Hawk told the newspapers. The former president easily won Idaho with 63.8% of the vote. But state officials audited Butte and Camas counties, which don't have voting machines. And so once again, there are seven counties in Idaho where there are no electronics involved in their voting. And yet he said that all counties had electronic shenanigans. Bonner County, which has sometimes uses machines to refute Lindell's claims, that's for the Butte, Camas, and Bonner counties. We have looked at how much exposure this particular set of data had gotten in the last several weeks. We felt it was reasonable at first to look in the counties that had no electronic means. Yeah. I'll actually come back to that in a second. Our premise was if we could get in there and out of two of those counties in one day and disprove the theory that was being alleged here, that it would go to good use of time. The Secretary of State's office ended its Bonner County audit last week and found a 0.01% margin of error across all three counties, which officials said showed the election was executed with both integrity and accuracy. Huck said the state would pay for the audits through the Federal Democracy Fund, but would return the money to the government if Lindell pays the bill, and the chief deputy said the office would consider suing the pillow magnate if he refuses to pay. This allegation is patently without merit on the first look, Huck said. It takes hard work to build confidence in a state's election system, and careless accusations like this can cause tremendous harm. Doing nothing and saying nothing would have been like conceding the truth, which I will give them credit. That is exactly what it is. But I will also say this. If Lindell actually wanted to, I think he actually could get out of this court case pretty easily by just saying, well, when I accused, I mean, walking into a courtroom and saying, well, when I said all counties in the state of Idaho had electronic shenanigans happening on them that cost Trump votes, that the state of Idaho should have realized I was pulling that out of my caboose when there were basically three counties, or it was seven counties that didn't have any electronics involved in it. So henceforth, they should have known I was making it up at that point. I mean, that's actually not a bad defense. He could pull that one off.
Shouldn't those guys kind of blame themselves? They listened to Lindell in the first place and based their audit on that.
I do like their last thing, though. Doing nothing and saying nothing would have been like conceding the truth. And I think that what they did is they basically went out and said it. But now they're saying, hey, you need to pay. But I think Lindell actually does have that out. You should have realized I was a stupid idiot and that I was just making this up. And if he goes into a courtroom and says that, well, it's as much as, you know, it's that's actually might be a pretty legitimate excuse.
Doesn't that open him up, though, to more lawsuits from Dominion and others? Basically, he would admit that he's an idiot and he's wrong. That could cause more problems than it solves.
We're not saying Mike Lindell is an idiot and wrong. No, we're not saying that at all. Not in the least bit. Nope. We're not saying this, but I'm just saying that could be his defense in the trial, that he could go out there and say, I'm an idiot and I was wrong. He could say that. I mean, that could be his defense. Just putting it out there, letting it hang. But we're not saying that. We're just saying that he could use that as a defense in this court case if he wanted to stop them from coming after him for $6,500, which, by the way, let's face it, that's the quaintest lawsuit you've got right now. Oh, how cute. It's $6,500. Oh. Lindell's also got another problem here. Okay. He so far failed to prove his allegations of voter fraud in the 2020 election, and now Salon reporter Zachary Patrizzo brings word that he has now claimed about election fraud are growing more outlandish. According to Patrizio, who frequently monitors Lindell's media appearances, the Trump-loving pillow salesman on Thursday said he discovered that someone who was 850 years old apparently voted in the 2020 presidential election. Oh, come on, Mike. That's just Chuck Grassley. Oh, that's... The whole point of the story was that one joke. There you go. Additionally, wait a second. Okay, so when Native Americans were here for thousands and thousands of years, a magnificent culture that was destroyed when Euros got here, they got here, 1492, that's when they started coming into the North American continent. Oh, at least in forest. I mean, the Vikings and possibly the Japanese got into the North American continent earlier, but this was 1492. That's not 850 years ago. I'm not. So, are they saying they've got a record of a Native American from 850 years ago who voted, or is this some guy from England who's been kicking it for a while? I guess.
Genghis Khan is around that age. Well, his ballot was signed G. Khan.
G. Khan. Gingy to his friends. You go catch him on TikTok. It's Gingy. God. Where did you even get the voting record from 850 years ago? Additionally, writes Patrizio, Lindell claimed that he and his team have identified 2,000 people over the age of 200 that voted. Lindell would not specify the names of the purported centurions or dead people. William Shakespeare? No.
It could be, yeah.
Dear Lord. Nor he would disclose the states that they supposedly voted in. No, I would really like to know those two stats. Lindell's claim. I'm going to guess what he's done is he's found a name that existed 200 or 850 years ago and basically found that there's someone today still has that same name. And so I'm going to guess, that's my guess that Lindell is doing, because I don't know, have any idea what else he's doing, if he's doing anything there.
To your previous point, that could help with the lawsuit, with that argument we were suggesting he can make.
That he was lying and that he's an idiot?
Yeah.
That Mike Lindell was lying and he's an idiot? I don't know if it'd work in that case. He could plead that. And we're not saying that. We're just saying that this could be his defense in these court cases. Yeah, it could be your defense. I mean, you can hire the law firm of McNeil and Brett to go in there and rep you. We will charge you a fine rate. Are you okay with going to Idaho?
Yeah.
We can go. We have your defense strategy already prepared.
I need to be paid in cash, knowingly.
No. And not pillows. No, I do not want to get paid in pillows or potatoes, either one. But the law firm of McNeil and Brett will proudly represent you in your Idaho case if you so desire. You already know what our strategy is. So just, no surprises. All right. That's where we're going with it. If that's how you want to plead. 952-946-6205. You've got a kind of a humdinger of an interview coming up here right now.
Oh yeah. We got the newly elected DFL Senate Minority Leader, Melissa Lopez Franzen, we're going to be talking through her ascendantship to the leadership role. That's a word, ascendant. I like that word.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we'll also talk about...
I make up words all the time. Yeah. I don't know if you noticed that or not, but it's okay with me.
Yeah, and then we'll talk, of course, about the frontline relief worker pay and where they're going with that. Hopefully casting a wider net than what the Republicans want for getting people money. So that's what we got.
Senator Melissa Franzen joining Brett Johnson right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson back with you here on a Friday afternoon. Happy to welcome the new leader of the Senate DFL, Melissa Lopez Franzen. She represents District 49, which includes portions of Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, Bloomington, and Edina. Also happens to be my own state senator, so happen to welcome her onto the show. Again, new DFL Senate leader, as we have a number of topics to talk about, including her new leadership role, as well as what's being debated at the state legislature with this COVID worker relief money. Senator Franzen, thanks so much for joining me on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I have to start off by saying this. It's really unusual in the state Senate or really any legislative chamber to have both caucus leaders, in this case the Republicans and the DFL, have their leaders step down at roughly the same time. What challenges have you been experiencing now that we've, of course, have two new Senate leaders right now in that chamber?
Well, it's not that we are new to the legislature, so the challenge is more on the timing and getting geared up for session, and in this particular instance, potentially a special session. So it's getting ducks in a row, staff organized, and just bringing your new vision for how to conduct ourselves in this next legislative session, but also in the next legislative cycle that has already started.
So what are you hoping to bring to the DFL chamber in the Senate as the new leader? What would you like to see?
Well, for me and for our caucus, we want unity. We want to be able to hit the ground running in this next election cycle as well as the legislative cycle. And we need to come together. We've had a really rough patch, just like any other workplace, with COVID and having remote session and ability to do hybrid session. And we've missed a lot of our colleagues, a lot of our new colleagues who, honestly, some did not meet their colleagues in person up until the very last part of the legislative session in May. So they were elected in November and had not even seen their colleagues until 6 or months plus. So it was challenging from a staffing standpoint as well, because we are still open for our constituents 24/7, and we have staff literally at the Capitol, but in this case also remotely. So those are challenges that we're overcome. So we're trying to get back into gear as well.
Now, as you mentioned, there could be a special session coming up within the next few days or weeks, and this has to do with about $250 million that was set aside by the state legislature that is intended as relief money for workers, of course, during last year's when we were in the worst of the pandemic. Now, we know the money is there. That was passed, the $250 million, but really the disagreement between Republicans and Democrats right now is who is going to get that money and where is that money going to be spent? So talk a little bit about the background of this and where you would like to see this money spent as opposed to the Republicans.
Well, Brett, you said when we were in the middle of the worst part of the pandemic, a little known fact is that we are really surging right now, and it's getting the numbers no are doubt. Starting to trend in the wrong direction with the Delta variant. And that is one of the pieces that we're still trying to deal with, because yes, we've trying to compensate workers for their heroic work in the midst of the pandemic, but we're still dealing with numbers rising and lack of workforce and lack of the inoculation in the whole population. So we're still seeing infection rates go up. So and even amongst children. So we want to make sure that we compensate these workers the $250 million that we agreed to. And that we also look forward to the future, how we're going to deal with the crisis right now in nursing homes, where we're also seeing, the issues don't stop, right? They just keep compounding. So let's put this, keep our promise, put this to rest and move forward. And how do we encourage this workplace and support this workplace for these workers that are still doing and are exhausted doing this work of taking care of Minnesotans?
So as I understand it right now, when it comes to this pot of $250 million, which has been set aside for the relief workers, the Democrats and, of course, the rest of the DFLers mostly want to cast a wide net for workers who could be eligible for this money. That could include people who are first responders, corrections officers, those that work in hospitals, nursing homes, others who work in schools, grocery stores, meatpacking plants, retail, shelters, airports, transit, and lots of other industries. While Republicans really want to narrow that focus, and their argument is saying that, well, we can offer this smaller group of people more money as opposed to the Democrats who want to cast a wider net and spread that money out a little bit more. What would you say to that Republican argument that they want to make things more meaningful, as they say, and have that money go to a smaller pot of workers?
Well, I think we as Democrats don't want to leave any person behind. And a lot of people put their lives on the risk, whether they were in the meatpacking industry or at a nursing home taking care of our seniors, and they're different settings, and we certainly know the level of risk. We have data that can help us figure that out, but to make it too narrow that we leave people who were vulnerable, because these jobs are also low-wage jobs, and we know we relied on them heavily, and they were still taking risk and going to different workplaces. I think we have to really understand the workplace, understand the risk levels, but we don't want to leave people behind and use the excuse that we want to have a meaningful check. I think people need to know that we appreciate the work and the work ethic that they remain during COVID, and that we are not forgetting their contributions to keeping us safe at home while they were working, because they were essential. So I wish we had a bigger pot, and I think we can have another discussion about that in our legislative session. But right now, let's keep this promise. Let's keep this net, this scope of people that really had a lot at risk and were lower-wage workers. We're not talking about doctors here. We are talking of people working in a hospital who were exposed because they were either dietitians or they were working in janitorial staff and also nurses. So those are the different people that we're talking about, but we're also talking about the meat packers and the folks who were in more exposed in their line of work as well, behind the scene in the food and distribution line.
We're speaking with Senator Melissa Lopez Franzen from District 49. She was recently elected the Senate Minority Leader for the DFL. And I want to go back to something you said a few minutes ago that, well, we're still in the worst of the pandemic. And I would most certainly agree with the type of surges we've been seeing over the past few weeks and months. And I think, as you were saying, it's important to make sure we don't forget some of these workers, especially, for instance, meatpacking plants, where I remember back in March and April of 2020, how we had so many workers that were coming down with COVID that had to miss time. It was a very rough time for a lot of our frontline workers or retail workers at grocery stores. So I think it's important, too, to make sure we don't forget about them, because it's easy to it can feel like it was about 10 years ago when we were in March or April of 2020, when we had so much support for those types of workers that, yeah, I think I agree with you there. We can't really forget about them as we head here into the rest of 2021.
Absolutely. And, you know, and we can talk about every single worker who helped us keep those classrooms open, those teachers that also put themselves at risk. So, you know, expanding the scope of this aid, I wish we can do more because there's so many people who went above and beyond to keep classrooms open, like I said, and also to really keep the economy propped up, were those people who didn't have the option of working from home. They actually had to physically go to work. And we should honor our promise. And if we have to go back and find more funds in the next session, so be it. But to limit the scope just because we don't have enough funding, I think it's not setting us up for success. And also, I mentioned the exhaustion of workers that are really doing overtime on many of these settings. So we have to acknowledge that.
Now, as I understand, there are a group of six lawmakers from both parties that are part of this bipartisan panel that are trying to work out a deal on where this $250 million is going to be spent and who is going to be getting it. Oh, have we heard any progress from this panel in terms of reaching an agreement before we get to the special session? What's the status right now?
Well, the status is whether we have a two-tier system, one for people who potentially workers that were at higher risk and exposed at higher levels than other settings. So trying to figure out if that's an equitable way to look at this and have a bigger check for those tier one and a second tier two versus having everyone, regardless of risk, getting the same amount and spreading that check. So that's where it's at right now. And I think we can get a pass. But the other piece that I think listeners should know is that the main reason we haven't passed this agreement is because the Republicans on the Senate side are set on firing a commissioner of health in the middle of a pandemic. So it's directly tied to the issue, because the same person who's guiding us during this pandemic is the same person that's keeping those workers safe. And to have that on the table as a condition of passing this money is ludicrous and, frankly, irresponsible.
Yeah, and that certainly is complicating the whole matter, is the fact that, as you said, the Republicans are threatened to remove yet more commissioners, something they already have done in the past. Now, I know Governor Walz has said he is not planning on calling a special session until there is an agreement which states that they will not be firing any more commissioners. And more specifically, we are talking, of course, about Health Commissioner Jan Malcolm, who has been a target of Republicans. I've always been curious about that statement from Walz, because is there anything that could prevent the GOP from breaking their word once we head into a special session? Or is it or is there anything you guys could do as the DFL to make sure they don't break their word if we do reach an agreement and they say, all right, we're not going to fire Malcolm or any other commissioners?
Well, Brett, in the almost 10 years I've been in the legislature, we've never gone to a special session without an agenda that all stakeholders, the majority and minority, sign on to. It's basically your blood and oath that this is what the agreement is, and it's never been challenged or changed. So I would hope that the Republicans can be trusted. And if there is no agreement, again, signed by the majority and the minority parties and leaders of each party in caucus, I don't think we'll go into special session, because if you can't give your word and sign on it and shake on it, then we have a completely different set of rules that we've never worked under. And I think it would set a really bad precedent for the state of Minnesota if we're going to be just playing politics with every single decision that we're going to make when a special session is needed in the future.
And final question for you here, Senator Melissa Lopez-Franz. And I know Governor Walz has proposed a $10 million relief package for people who have been affected by the drought that we've seen this year. What are the prospects for getting that sort of money passed during this special session, since obviously we have plenty of Minnesotans who have been hurt by the drought we've seen this summer and fall?
Absolutely. I think that is an issue that we can all compromise and certainly agree on. I think people know that I was at Farm Fest this year for other reasons, namely a really bad accident. But the fact that I was there was to listen to people and farmers about how this drought and other issues affect the farming community. And the fact that we heard back then in August that this was an issue and it was going to become increasingly so, and we're still hearing from farmers, especially those on the cattle side of farming, that this is a big issue and that they need the support from the government. And that is what we're here for, to help. We've done this before. When there's a flood, we've done it in droughts. We've done it in you know, emergency situations when it comes to the weather. And this is our duty, to step up and help our neighbors, and in this case, our farmers. And the DFL has an F in DFL that stands for farmer. And we're going to be, you know, hold on our bargain to help farmers during this drought. And I think we can get that done in a special session.
We've been speaking with State Senator Melissa Lopez-Franz in District 49, which includes a portion of the Southwest Metro, including the cities of Edina, Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, and Bloomington, parts of all four of those cities. She is also the newly elected DFL Senate leader, as we've been talking through some of the recent news from the state legislature and the possible upcoming special session on worker relief pay. Senator Lopez-Franz, and thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, too. Have a good one.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
Oh, that's appropriate. Very nicely done. If you don't recognize this song, by the way, the song we're playing right now, it is actually a James Bond song. It is the theme song from Quantum of Solace from Jack White and Alicia Keys. And it's one of the better songs. I've always really liked that song.
A good song, but probably not the best Daniel Craig Bond movie.
No, it wasn't. I don't think it's as bad. I think it's an underrated Bond film, because I think a lot of people, and it's not as good as the best ones. But it's because I do like the plot. They're trying to steal the water in Bolivia. it was pretty ambitious one. But that's one of the best soundtracks. I'm going to spend the rest of the show we have been, you know, a lot of heaviness here. Today, the latest in the James Bond franchise, No Time to Die, opens up. It's the last one with Daniel Craig. He's vowed that he is not going to do another one. And I believe him. I don't think he wants to do another one. So I have to go see it. Brett, how much of a Bond fan are you?
I was a big Bond fan as a kid. I still keep up with them now. I think I've seen all the recent ones. But yeah, I consider myself a fan.
We'll start off with the obvious question. Who do you think is the best Bond?
That kind of depends on which type of Bond you like. Because
this is, oh, for God's sakes, just who is your favorite, dude?
Who's my favorite?
Who's your favorite?
I don't know. I could appreciate some of the Roger Moore comedy they have there, but ultimately, you got to go Connery. I mean, how can you not?
Actually, you want to know something that's very interesting since Sean Connery died last year? Since he died last year, a lot of lists have moved Connery down the list.
Really?
And I think to a point, it's because, you know, his Bond was pretty brash. Well, and it was a 60s Bond. You know, and so, you know, this was in the day and age before a lot of things, you know.
Yeah, he was not a progressive Bond. No,
this is,
for sure.
There are some things in there that are a little tough to watch. Well, and we have to remember, too, Roger Moore, the man with the golden gun. He kind of beats up a woman in that one. You remember that one? Is it Maude Adams? He, you know, kind of smacks around on that, and it's like, oh, yikes.
Well, then Live and Let Die is kind of a blaxploitation film you can make an argument for, too.
Yeah, very much so. No, they really kind of, as you look at the films, although Yaphet Kotto is so good in that. Oh, God, is he one of the, he's one of the best villains they've ever had. He was absolutely a great villain. You kind of like Connery. I am a Roger Moore. I like Roger Moore because I think that of the Bond films, here's how I'd rank them. I'd rank Roger Moore, Daniel Craig, Sean Connery.
If you remember who played the other ones, I kind of struggled.
Timothy Dalton.
Yeah.
George Lorenzby, who did only one, which is on Her Majesty's Secret Service. And I should say only one within the main context, the main continuity here. And then Pierce Brosnan. Let me start with Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, you're not a fan of Pierce Brosnan?
The problem with Pierce Brosnan was because he became too much of a character. And a friend of mine said this. He said that if you look at the Pierce Brosnan Bond films, the best part of all of them is the opening scene. So Goldeneye, that was him and Sean Bean and the mountain lair where they have to jump on the plane, which is great. In Tomorrow Never Dies, that's the jet plane. I don't know if he has to steal the jet plane at the last second with a nuclear bomb on it. That's pretty good. What was the one after that one?
Is that the one where he got tortured in that prison?
Oh, no, that was Die Another Day. World Is Not Enough. That was the boat chase on the Thames in downtown London after they blew up MI6. And then, Die Another Day. That was when he was on the North Korean border and he did the fan boats and he flew. And let's face it, all four of those movies, those opening sequences are brilliant. And then the rest of the movie, I will say though, there you go with him. I've got Lorenz V just did one. And, I mean, he was really good. Honor Majesty's Secret Service is a really good film. I thought, I mean, Telly Savalas, the bad guy in that one, as Blofeld, right? I believe it's Blofeld in that one. It's so good. I think Dalton gets derided too much because License to Kill was a little bit bad, although License to Kill has the best stunt they ever did in that entire franchise. The 18-wheeler up on its side wheels and the rocket goes underneath it.
Oh, really?
George Miller, you know, Road Warrior type of a shot they did there. But that is a brilliant stunt they did there. And that's, if you go back and watch it, I went and watched it. That's real world. That looks like a real world thing. They got the semi up on its side tires and they shot something underneath it. Not a missile, obviously, but impressive. Then, of course, Connery is iconic. Although, Dr. No, Russia with Love, You Only Live Twice.
Yeah, Goldfinger in there. That's
Goldfinger, Thunderball, and then Diamonds Are Forever, I think, are really good. The other ones, you know, they're not as good. I mean, Goldfinger is iconic. And Thunderball is, I think, a bit underrated. That's a nuclear bomb in Miami, if I remember correctly, right? And Goldfinger was, you were going to rob Fort Knox. Thunderball is the bomb, nuclear bomb in Miami. And Diamonds Are Forever. Oh, what was that? Something with space. They were going to activate the San Andreas Fault. Remember they were going to activate? Well, that's the second one. They did Live and Let a View to a Kill. They had Christopher Walken as the bad guy in that one.
Oh, right, right. That's right.
And Right on Schedule. I love that. There's there. But, I just don't think, you know, some of those early ones, Dr. No was okay. Rush with Love was okay. You Only Live Twice. I don't remember. That one also kind of a tough one to watch at times. Then, of course, Daniel Craig, who, you're right, he has been inconsistent. Craig has been inconsistent. Casino Royale, it's one of my top three movies of all time of the Bond films. I mean, that film is great. But Quantum of Solace was not where near it. And I guess it's hard when it's, you know, you have such a good one and then it's hard to follow it up. Skyfall is great, too. Spectre was the... Christopher Walken, wasn't that Christopher Walken as the bad guy?
Oh, yeah. He's Blofeld in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then No Time to Die, which comes on out right now. So it was good. But Roger Moore, Roger Moore had the impossible job of taking over for Connery. They had, Live and Let Die, it's the you're right, it is a bit of a black exploitation film in that film. I will say, though, that the stunts they do, the Gator Ranch and the boat chase are iconic, as good as they get.
Oh, I forgot about it. Yeah.
The boat, as a matter of fact, didn't they set the world record for boat jump in filming that? And they held it for a long time when they were jumping them over the roads with the sheriff, the guy that played the sheriff, who came back for...
Sheriff guy.
who was, okay, the one thing I hated about the Moore films was they kept bringing back guys. So they brought him back for The Man with the Golden Gun. That was just ludicrous. In the same way, the Spy Who Loved Me. How great is that film with Jaws? You know, that as the villain, who could be the best villain. He would be probably the best villain if not for the fact that they brought him back for the atrocious Moonraker. Moonraker was a Bond film they made just because they wanted to make a Star Wars-like film. And so all of a sudden, MI6 is in space with laser beams. Okay, what the hell, man? Stop it. But no, that it Jaws was. Remember when? Did you ever see that when For Your Eyes or The Spy Who Loved Me, in Egypt when he gets to the guy and he opens it? Man, that's creepy, man. That was but I think of all the Bond films, and I know this is going to be this is where we're going to start making people mad. Well, I already made people mad because I didn't say Connery was number one. But
that's probably true.
Here's where I'm going to make people really mad. You know what my favorite Bond film is? For Your Eyes Only. For Your Eyes Only. I don't know if you remember that one. That was, it's Roger Moore. Someone steals the thing off the boat and they have to track it down. And it's a much more like a spy film. And you don't know who really the bad guy is for a good chunk of the film. And in that film, I think the end scene where they're doing the mountain climbing scene to get to the evil lair at the top is one of the best filmed action sequences. I remember that, and I just really loved that movie. For Your Eyes Only, I just really enjoyed that. I think they've got the was the guy coming after him with the Zamboni, or he beats the guy with the Zamboni.
I think that
I like that one. I always like For Your Eyes Only. Octopussy had one of the best fight scenes of all time. The yo-yo saw, man. Don't you remember the yo-yo saw?
I do not know. The yo-yo saw?
The yo-yo saw. That was great. Oh, that was a very good one. But I mean, and that also had a good, that was, they were going to blow up the nuclear bomb, on the military base in West Germany. So that was a good, I like that one. A View to a Kill. The axe fight scene on top of the Golden Gate Bridge. How great is that? With him and Christopher Walken. Just Ugh. And yeah, I thought A View to a Kill is a very good film. I like that one a lot. Living Daylights, that was Dalton's first one. That wasn't a bad one. I will say, as much as I just dogged on, and of course, yeah, I've made people mad that our friend, you know, the problem with Pierce Brosnan was that Pierce Brosnan, when he was Remington Steele, remember that TV show? Do you remember?
I do not remember Remington Steele.
I am an old man now, aren't I? I'm 850 years old, and I just voted in the election. I remember back when we had Remington Steele on the air. Stephanie Zimbalis, wasn't that Stephanie Zimbalis with him on that show? I believe. God, I'm just an old man. Like, I remember the day. Let's turn on Nick at Night. Anyhow, the problem was he played Remington Steele like he was Bond, and that's why everyone said he should be the next James Bond.
Oh.
But he never really got away from the Remington Steele. Roger Moore was the saint, the old saint on TV for many years, but he became a very different character when he played Bond. So, I will say this about Pierce Brosnan. If the semi truck from A License to Kill with the rocket going underneath is the best, the second best action sequence of that is the tank chase in St. Petersburg of the entire Bond series.
Oh, yeah.
That is brilliant. They did some damage with that. That was good.
Pierce Brosnan's kind of interesting for, I think, people my age, maybe in their 20s or 30s, because you know what made him and I think got a lot of people back into Bond was the video game GoldenEye that they released back in like 96.
Which was really that was one of the biggest, was the,
one
fir-
of the, biggest
was
of
the
all
first
time.
Crossover ones, wasn't it? Was the first ones to come on over. I knew so many people that played that game. They loved that game. Also, Sean Bean.
That got
Bean.
Me into the Bond movies. Yeah, it was just that video game. I think that's true for a lot of people.
Yeah, Sean Bean is great in that movie, too.
Oh, he is. Yeah. He's.
So, okay, so what is your favorite action sequence of all the Bond films?
I forgot about the tank scene. That's pretty good. Another good scene in GoldenEye where I think he gets ejected from the helicopter seat as a bomb is going off. He just happens to time it perfectly.
Boys with their toys. Yes, boys with toys. That's a good scene.
Skyfall had a good scene, too, where they have what's-his-face coming in and playing. I can't think of the name of the song. He's in on that helicopter. They're going to attack Bond.
Oh, they're playing when they go up to the mansion at the end.
Yeah, you probably
Javier Bardem?
That's him.
Bad guy, yeah.
But he's blaring like boom, 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 that song the whole time. I thought that was kind of cool and fitting, yeah.
I thought the best action sequence from the Daniel Craig series was the parkour chase in Casino Royale, where they're jumping through the construction zone. Let's face it, that where it ends up in the embassy. That was a pretty good. Okay, this is not like Pierce Brosnan, and I think they did that. I mean, they try to do that. There are some franchises where you have to change things up, and I mean, I'm about to establish my nerd cred once again. I love Doctor Who. They have had so many versions of the Doctor, but when you take over for one, especially one that's been a popular character, you've got to change things up dramatically because you can't have the same thing. Same thing that goes. I think that was part of the problem with Brosnan, Pierce Brosnan. They kind of changed things up and made it far more gritty and more realistic in Daniel Craig's run, and you know, showing him getting hurt a lot of times, because also that has that great scene in the Miami airport.
That
chase scene there. Yeah. So, no, Casino Royale is a great film. Are you going to go see No Time to Die?
Yeah, I'll definitely be seeing that at some point. Yeah, because I know they're bringing Christoph Waltz back as Blofeld, which will be kind of fun. He's a supporting character this time, not the main villain.
Well, it's okay. So, of the Bond themes, because Billie Eilish does this one. Now it's okay, I'm going to once again make people mad. On Spectre, it was Sam Smith, and that was not a good song. That was not a good song, especially following up Adele from Skyfall. That was a great song. I'd say pound for pound, Daniel Craig's had the best songs. Chris Cornell, You Know My Name, Another Way to Die, Jack White and Alicia Keys, Adele with Skyfall. We have Jury's Out on Billie Eilish. I haven't heard it. I was going to hear it, try to listen to it before I got into the show today. But, you know, it's the Pierce Brosnan one, I think Tina Turner was the best of them, which is Goldeneye. She did Goldeneye, which I thought was a good show.
The best of all the themes, though, got to be the Live and Let Die theme. That's such an eye.
You
don't like that one? That just fits Bond, though.
Okay. And do I like that one? Yes. It's a Live and Let Die. Paul McCartney and Wings. Roger Moore, his first outing. I like that song a lot. I will say the one that Nobody Does It Better by Carly Simon is a great song. You remember that from The Spy Who Loved Me?
Oh,
we forget that was the song in there. That's a great one. You go back to, Goldfinger for Shirley Bassey was a great song. And Thunderball from Tom Jones is also a great song from the original run. I forget that Louis Armstrong did On Her Majesty's Secret Service, the song from that one.
Oh, I'm totally blanking. Louis Armstrong did a Bond theme?
We have all the time in the world.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, he did all. Yeah.
Listen to that one, yeah.
Shirley Bassey, Lulu. Oh, the worst has got to be The Man with the Golden Gun. The Man with the Golden Gun. Oh, dear Lord. That is the most nerve-wracking Bond film. Oh, The Man with the Golden Gun is bad. And I'll take schmaltzy, soft rock, all those ones they did for Moonraker and License to Kill, and I'll take those in a heartbeat. But that Lulu song is garbage. I'm sorry, the best Bond song of all time and one of the best songs from the 1980s, View to a Kill from Duran Duran. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, that's a good.
That is such a great song. It is. Aha did one. The Living Daylights did. They did the Living Daylights one. Yeah, I mean, they really started getting star power starting after Gladys Knight and License to Kill. The song I just talked. schmaltzy. It was they went, Tina Turner. I think Goldeneye is a great song because she did it. She like Adele. Tina Turner and Adele did it right. You do that Shirley Bassey kind of, lounge singer version of the song, and it becomes iconic. And they figured it out. But still, A View to a Kill by Duran Duran. That is a great song. Hey, by the way, guess what? When we come back, I'm going to do some dancing. Final break. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Here we go. We're going out with this. Dance into the weekend. You have a fantastic weekend. We are going to be back on a Monday. James Bond, it is. Duran Duran. Music to dance with. Have a good one. Till Monday. See ya.
Meeting you with a view to a kill. Face to face.